From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actress Felicity Huffman and her husband, actor William H. Macy. The two have collaborated on the new film Transamerica. Huffman stars as a male-to-female transsexual. Macy is the film's executive producer. The great jazz pianist and composer Dave Brubeck turns 85 years old next week, and he'll celebrate with a concert with the London Symphony. We listen back to an interview with him. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new film Syriana, and we'll have a review of the new Showtime miniseries Sleeper Cell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. In a moment, we're going to hear an interview Terry recorded earlier this year with two great actors who are also married, Felicity Huffman and William H. Macy. Huffman has become a household name and an Emmy winner as a result of her role on Desperate Housewives as Lynette. She also starred in the critically acclaimed but short-lived series Sports Night. William H. Macy received an Oscar nomination for his role in Fargo and won writing and acting Emmys for his telemovie Door to Door. His other movies include Seabiscuit and Boogie Nights. Now Macy is the executive producer of a new movie called Transamerica. It stars Felicity Huffman, who won the Best Actress Award when the film played earlier this year at the Tribeca Film Festival. Huffman plays a transsexual man preparing to have final gender reassignment surgery and already passing as a genetic female. In this scene, she's being evaluated for the surgery by a psychiatrist. A heads up to parents, the scene has a passing reference which may not be appropriate for young children.
Do you consider yourself a happy person?
Yes. I mean, no. I mean, I will be.
Miss Osborne, there's no such thing as a right answer in this office.
Yes, I'm a very happy person.
How can I help you if you won't be honest with me?
You can sign that consent form, please.
The American Psychiatric Association categorizes gender dysphoria as a very serious mental disorder.
After my operation, not even a gynecologist will be able to detect anything out of the ordinary about my body. I will be a woman. Don't you find it odd that plastic surgery can cure a mental disorder?
How do you feel about your penis?
It disgusts me. I don't even like looking at it.
What about friends?
They don't like it either.
No, I mean, do you have the support of friends?
I'm very close to my therapist.
What about your family?
My family is dead.
Felicity Huffman, William H. Macy, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Felicity, the kind of woman that you're playing as a man who's becoming a woman is a different kind of woman than I suspect you are. In other words...
What are you saying?
Here's exactly what I'm saying, that he's kind of inhabiting a kind of woman who is probably female in a way that's slightly different than you are, with an almost studied wiggle in the walk. Mm-hmm. And, we'll talk about learning the voice in a second, but he's learned how to be a woman, and you just are a woman. And there's a certain type of female manner that I think people who are transsexuals adopt that's a little different than than a lot of women who are just women, who are in some ways less feminine.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a journey, because most transgendered people who are transgendered do it later in life when they actually have the finances to do it, because it's very expensive. And also, you know, after quite a few years, 30 or 40, of struggling with this decision, because, you know, they're caught between a rock and a hard place. Either they can be alienated from themselves, you know, not presenting who they really are, or they can have the sexual reassignment surgery, and then they're going to be alienated from society. So it takes a long time before you're willing to sacrifice society for yourself, if that's clear. And the reason I preface that is because you take a 40-year-old guy and you say, all right, starting tomorrow, I want you to wear a dress and earrings and makeup and present to the world as a woman, because you have to dress as a woman for a year before you are okayed for the sexual reassignment surgery. And, you know, they don't know how to do that.
A lot of women don't know how to do that.
Yeah, myself included. So, yeah, I think what I chose for Sabrina Claire Osborne, which is what my name was in the movie, Brie, it was a very studied, learned, almost beauty pageant kind of femininity, because she had to go to that extreme to learn it before she could find it in herself. I think in the last scene of the movie, you can see her being a little more settled in her own femininity. I also happen to know a lot of transgendered women who you know, are completely comfortable being a woman and aren't that sort of mannerisms, don't have those kind of mannerisms that I adopted in the movie.
Felicity, the movie starts with you're a character watching a videotape of a woman demonstrating for pre-op transsexuals how to place their voice so that they sound more like a woman. And that's the kind of thing you try to, your character tries to achieve through the movie. And there's something that's so convincing about what you've done with your voice for the film. Could you talk a little bit about placing it for the movie?
Sure. Let me give you some background, though. sexual reassignment surgery and hormone therapy does not alter the vocal cords. So you can have someone that looks like Kate Moss sound like James Earl Jones. And it's one of the most difficult challenges they have because it's hard to find your female voice. And the woman at the beginning of the movie who you see in the videotape is Andrea James. And that's one of the things she does is she coaches, as you said, she coaches men how to sound like women. And, you know, you want to sound authentic. You don't want to sound like, you don't want to sound like a guy, but you also don't want to sound like Tony Curtis in Some Like It Hot. Women don't even have the chest cavity or the head cavity that men have to drop it down. I mean, you saw Andrea on that film go, oh, you know, finish up for me, Bill. She went, yeah, she went down like that. So I couldn't find a way to do it. And I knew it was key. And I finally went to, we were rehearsing in New York, and I went to a wonderful voice coach named Katie Bull. And through a bunch of work, we figured out how to find a voice that sounded like it was in transition, which is as close as I could get.
The thing that Felicity did that's so great in this film is that you, we now all know her very well because of Desperate Housewives, and you look at this character and you know it's Felicity in there somewhere, but it's just all a little wrong. It was perfect. She really has done a number. She erased her face somehow. I don't know how she did it.
And then, exactly. Yeah.
And then painted it back on. So it's her face, but it's just not right somehow.
I noticed that actually just watching it. And what I was thinking about that was that, Felicity, tell me if you think this is right, that you didn't want to... Your face is almost like a mask in the movie, as if you're trying to not betray too much of what you're feeling, because what you're feeling at this point is such kind of confusion. And so...
No, she's not feeling confusion. What she's feeling is intense, and I can't think of the right word, it's like intense Mach 4 of self-consciousness, because she doesn't represent to the world the way she feels inside. So all she can hope is she comes in under the radar, you know, just don't look at me. I'm not tall, I'm not big. You know, she doesn't know how to do her makeup. You know, her hair's a little funky from the hormones, which happens. And so it's not that she's lost, it's that...
What's the phrase they use when they're made? When they're
clocked.
Clocked. When someone realizes that it's a transgendered person, they're clocked. And that's the biggest fear.
Yeah, they just... Yeah, they live in... Yeah, it's horrible because you're pointed out as, ooh, a freak.
Bill Macy, the last time you were on Fresh Air, this was like 1993, we talked a lot about your approach to acting and what you'd learned from working with David Mamet in theater and in movies. And I remember you talking about how you're not into the method and you're into always asking, like, what's your motive? Like, why? What do you want the other person to do? What are you trying? What action are you trying to get them to do with what you're saying? And... it's kind of different from, like, the method approach of, like, drawing on your deepest emotional memories that might approximate what the character is going through. Do you both have the same approach to acting? Do you?
I think we do. And I think Transamerica is an excellent example of that. Felicity has a serious characterization to do. Her voice is different. Her walk is different. Her look is different. Every physical thing about her is different. But why the film works so well is that she didn't forget to act. And that happens so often for an actor. When it's a high-wire act with this characterization, you forget to act. You forget to look at the other person. And the reason the film works so well is that it's just her, ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we approach work the same way. I mean, I was constantly, because Bill was home a lot with the girls. I would say several times a day I was calling Bill for coaching on a scene, and we work that way a lot. I call him from Desperate Housewives.
What kind of advice do you ask?
Oh, I read the scene over there. I fax him the scene or the rewrites, and we read it together, and I sort of say, what do you think it means? What do you think she wants? How should I approach it?
We do it with each other. Sometimes you can miss the forest for the trees when it's a scene.
Yeah, I can, yeah.
When it's a scene, you have to act in moments, really. An outsider can look at it with a little bit fresher eye, really.
William H. Macy and Felicity Huffman speaking with Terry Gross. Huffman stars in the new movie Transamerica, which Macy produced. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Our guests are Felicity Huffman and William H. Macy, two great actors who are also married.
How did you both meet, Bill?
The Atlantic Theater Company.
Through the Atlantic Theater Company in New York City.
You were both acting in it?
I was teaching and Felicity was a student, but I didn't touch her, Terry. I didn't touch her until long after she had graduated, hours after she had graduated.
Oh, so
can't believe you said that. I was so willing to go
let
right
it go.
Around it.
It's the word's out. There's no hiding anymore.
All right.
Was that awkward while you were her teacher?
We didn't get together until after I was graduated.
The company had
it
been
was the
formed
theater
for a while.
Company. Yeah.
Our relationship was really more of company members.
Yeah.
And
except that all the girls had crushes on Bill. I have to tell you.
Now she tells me.
let me play a scene of you together, and this is from the series Sports Night, in which Felicity Huffman, you played a producer of an ESPN-type sports show. And Bill Macy, for a few episodes, you played a consultant who's brought in to boost the ratings, and you have very strong opinions of how to do that, and you're trying to tell the producers what they should be doing to improve the show. So here's a scene where you've come into the control room and you're telling the producer, Felicity Huffman, what she should do.
Hey.
Good evening.
Show seems a little stiff tonight, don't you think?
Yes, I do.
Maybe even stiffer than last night.
I believe it is.
You know why?
Because you're freaking everyone out?
Could be.
Stand by 57 and 58.
You know what I'd do if I were you?
Kill myself?
No, I'd whisper in their ear.
I beg your pardon?
The two of you, whisper something in their ear.
What are you talking about?
Men like the sound of a woman whispering in their ear. They get playful.
Why don't we just get them a lap dance?
No, we don't have that kind of time, but I like your thinking.
Listen.
Whisper in their ear.
I'm not whispering in their ear. Natalie's not whispering in their ear.
If you want,
Kim's not whispering in their ear. You've gotten everything you've wanted. We've been totally cooperative, but I'm afraid from 11 to 12, this is my show. And I'll deal with things the way I deal with things.
Okay.
That's William H. Macy and Felicity Huffman in a scene from the former ABC series Sports Night, which is out on DVD. So when you worked on that together, did you talk, again, you know, like your approach to acting has to do with what are you getting the other person to do by saying what you say? Did you talk about that kind of thing with each other, or should you not show your cards to each other when you're going to be in a scene together?
No, we totally show our cards to each other. Yeah.
And
it's
that doesn't diminish the power or anything because the other character knows how you're trying to manipulate them.
No, because it lives in the moment. It doesn't live in what you practiced in the dressing room or at rehearsal in the afternoon. It lives in the moment. And If Bill does something different, I'll react differently. And if I do something different, he reacts differently. So you don't bring in something you rehearsed earlier. You live in the moment, and that's constantly changing.
And it's not as if it's a secret. I mean, if a scene is well written, it's pretty clear what's going on. The playwright is not out to trick us. He's out to make it as clear as possible.
Yeah. And Aaron Sorkin, wasn't it fun to hear that?
Oh, well, that guy can write.
That guy can write.
He could do it professionally.
Yeah, he could.
So this scene sounds like it was a lot of fun to do.
That whole series was fun to do.
It was fantastic. It was so great to have Bill come on. And we got to make out and get paid for it.
I always think that when you start out doing David Mamet plays, as you both did, that in some ways it's got to be all downhill from there. I mean, how many people write dialogue on that level? Have you ever felt, either of you, in roles where... Like it was, you know, it was a good part, you should be doing it, but it just wasn't kind of reaching that level that you wanted.
Various scripts bring various things to the table. David can certainly write dialogue as well or better than anybody else, but sometimes there's a great story to be told, or sometimes it's a great character to play, or... sometimes the dynamic with all the characters. There's different elements to the party each time. It doesn't have to be Mamet dialogue each time.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Mamet dialogue is a double-edged sword. On one hand, it's fun to speak, but it's impossible to learn and very complicated.
Why? And difficult to do well.
Why is it complicated and difficult?
He writes in iambic pentameter most of the time, and it's a very... The wording is very specific, and it's not casual.
It's not casual at all. Sometimes when you read a Mamet script, it takes you three or four readings just to understand exactly what the characters say. And interestingly, when you read it, you'll read a sentence on the page, and you're not sure what it means. But the second you say it out loud, it's clear.
Yeah.
He has a tendency to cut some of the words out of a speech, as we do in natural speech.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Macy, in one of your recent movies, The Cooler, you had a sex scene with Maria Bello.
A sex scene?
Right, okay, several. And we also got to see you naked from behind. And I guess I'm wondering if, you know, I think that was like the first time on screen that you were... naked from behind. Was that like an issue for you? And I ask you this in part because it got so much attention. Like, people were saying, oh, AC's doing a sex scene. But I guess I'm wondering whether that was something that made you uncomfortable, how you reacted to the reaction to it.
I was nervous about it. I'm north of 50 years old, so the idea of taking off my clothes in front of all the world was daunting. But Maria Bello is very, very cool about it, and she said it was no big deal. Felicity was supportive about it. She said, you've got a nice rear end. And ultimately, just like anything, if it advances the plot, if it's good storytelling, I'm willing to do it. And the only thing that I wish is that I'd started working out a little bit earlier before I had to do that, but yeah, it made me nervous. I had my acting teacher was on set with me. His name's Jim Beam. That helped a lot.
Oh, I get it. I was going to say, what a coincidence. Well, but that could really dull your senses, that Jim Beam.
That's what I needed, dulled senses. It looks like it would be. I just had to watch Felicity making out for an hour on ABC the other night.
I kissed Doug Savant. That's all I did. Bill is naked with Maria Bello, who's what, 10 years younger than me, and
kiss
stunning.
Doug Savant,
and shut
you
up.
Did
shut up.
Surgery
and like
on his
10
mouth.
10 pounds lighter than me. Bill's running around naked. She's like got her hands on young Will and the twins. I mean, it's unbelievable. But suddenly he can't look at me because I'm going to be kissing Doug Savant.
No, I know you're kidding each other now, but does it really make you uncomfortable when you see that?
I hate it.
You're so sweet.
I hate it. I just don't watch. I sort of look away and hum so I can so I can't even hear the dialogue. I don't need to see that. What am I going to say to her? Hey, good job, honey. Boy, that guy's going to stay kissed for a while.
Well, I think you're both great, and I really appreciate your talking with us today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Thank you. I love your program.
We think you're great, too.
Yeah. Oh, gee, thanks.
William Macy and Felicity Huffman speaking with Terry Gross. Huffman co-stars in the TV show Desperate Housewives and has the starring role in the new film Transamerica, which Macy produced. Here's a song from the Desperate Housewives companion CD. It starts with a clip of Felicity Huffman as Lynette. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
And I started taking the pills because they gave me energy. It's so humiliating. Other moms don't need help. Other moms make it look so easy. All I do is complain.
What a drag it is getting old. Kids are different today. I hear every mother say, mother needs something today to calm her down. And though she's not really ill, there's a little yellow pill. She goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper, and it helps her on her way, gets her through her busy day. Things are different today. I hear every mother say, cooking fresh food for her husband's just a drag. So she buys an instant cake and she burns a frozen steak and goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper, and to help her on her way gets her.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations and Barnes & Noble, publishers of Anthony Trollope's satire of Money Madness, The Way We Live Now, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, in stores and online. Additional support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Retirement for Two, everything you need to know to thrive together as long as you both shall live.
Jazz composer and pianist Dave Brubeck turns 85 years old next week. But there'll be no time out for him. He's still playing and performing. Coming up, we feature an interview with Dave Brubeck. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new film Syriana, and we'll have a review of the new Showtime miniseries Sleeper Cell. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. George Clooney hasn't shied away from political and social issues off or on the screen. His film Good Night and Good Luck was about the McCarthy era and the news media. Now, as an executive producer and star of Syriana, he looks at the U.S. involvement in the Persian Gulf. The film is the directorial debut of Stephen Gagan, who won an Oscar in 2000 for his screenplay of Traffic. David Edelstein has a review.
That handsome rogue, George Clooney, must have been eager to transform himself into a burnout with a messy beard and a potbelly. In Syriana, he plays Bob Barnes, a Persian Gulf CIA operative, often undercover and never much concerned with the big picture, only with the minutiae of his missions, which include arranging assassinations of foreign leaders. When we meet him, he's making an arms deal with, well, I'm not sure. terrorists of one stripe or another, they get blown up, or their car does. I think this is a flashback. Look, to explain the plot of Syriana, I'd need a blackboard and flowcharts. The writer and director, Stephen Gagan, is a student of British miniseries like, well, Traffic, which he adapted for the American screen. He likes narratives with multiple characters and multiple twisty subplots, and he's probably right to think a linear technique wouldn't fully serve the story of a tangled alliance between U.S. intelligence agencies and big oil companies to control the fate and the oil of a Persian Gulf kingdom. He's just a tad remiss in giving us our bearings, so it's hard to distinguish the pointedly jumbled from the totally inept. Syriana hinges on two energy companies that are merging to create a corporation with revenues greater, we're told, than the gross domestic products of Pakistan and Denmark. An unusually low-key Jeffrey Wright plays an investigator for a private law firm hired to keep the Justice Department at bay. I was never entirely sure who hired him. It's hard to distinguish among the old white men who lecture him throughout the movie. Well, there's no mistaking Christopher Plummer, who plays some kind of military-industrial intelligence complex kingpin, and who summons Wright in secret to establish a back channel of communication. Plummer is amazing, so sleek, so saturnine, so redolent of malevolent power. I never did figure out who he was, though. Maybe we should hear a scene from the movie. Here's Clooney's Barnes trying to toe the CIA line on Iran for the Condi Rice-like representative of the administration. He's stuck between his agency's agenda and, well, reality.
And our analysis seems to be on the mark. We're getting good satellite coverage. We're reprogramming resources into
Thank
Iran.
Thank you for coming over, Mr. Barnes. Next. Welcome back, and forgive me if I wade right in, but forgetting for a second your bureaucratic checklist, I'm trying to get undigested information.
Well, to the best of our ability.
India is now our ally. Russia is now our ally. Even China will be an ally. Everybody between Morocco and Pakistan is the problem. Failed states and failed economies, but Iran is a natural cultural ally of the U.S. Are we going to have a nice, secular, pro-Western, pro-business government?
It's possible. It's complicated.
Of course it is, Mr. Barnes. Thank you for your time.
They let young people march in the street, and the next day they shut down 50 newspapers. But if you satellite dishes up on the roofs, let them have my two dads, that doesn't mean that the Ayatollahs are surrendering one iota of control over that nation.
Mr. Barnes, the reform movement in Iran is one of the president's great hopes for the region and crucial to the petroleum security of the United States.
These gentlemen are with the CLI.
The Committee for the Liberation of Iran, Mr. Barnes.
You get a sense from that of all the interests in conflict, and there are many more. Hang on, let me find my flowchart. There's a Pakistani oil field worker who's brusquely fired from his job after the giant merger and who drifts steadily into radical Islamist politics. And the film's other big star, Matt Damon, plays an ambitious but fundamentally decent energy analyst who sells his services to a Persian Gulf kingdom. The aging emir has two sons, both potential heirs. One, played by Alexander Siddig, is an intellectual and reformer who makes a pipeline deal with the Chinese instead of the Americans because their offer is much better. The other is a lazy, ignorant, corrupt playboy who's happy to jump into bed with anyone who'll give him kickbacks. Guess which brother the U.S. administration supports and which brother it wants assassinated. Syriana depicts an incestuous link between America's private and public sectors, both rife with cronyism, arrogance, and incompetence. It's what some on the right would call a left-wing Chomskyite Hate America First movie, and parts of it are laughably simplistic, not to mention incoherent. But in the last half hour, when the threads finally do coalesce, when Gagan draws a straight line, the only straight line in the movie, from U.S. malfeasance to the birth of a terrorist, Syriana feels so spooky and dead on that I found myself thinking, maybe the most cynical and convoluted explanation is actually the most plausible one.
David Edelstein is the film critic for the online magazine Slate. Coming up, Dave Brubeck. This is Fresh Air. Money. 51 years ago, polls in the two leading jazz magazines, Metronome and Downbeat, selected pianist Dave Brubeck's group as the best instrumental group of the year. 5 years later, Brubeck was on the cover of Time magazine. In 1959, the Dave Brubeck Quartet recorded Time Out, which included the tune Take Five. It became the first jazz album to sell a million copies. The album illustrated the group's approach to counterpoint and lightly swinging, eccentric rhythms, as in the song we're listening to now, Three to Get Ready. There have been many milestones in Dave Brubeck's life and career. He'll mark another one next Tuesday, when he celebrates his 85th birthday. Terry spoke with him in 1999. She asked about his childhood in California. His mother was a music teacher and pianist. His father was a cattle rancher. The family took over a large cattle ranch when Dave Brubeck was 11 years old.
My dad was the manager of the 45,000-acre ranch, but he owned his own 1,200-acre ranch, and I owned four cattle that he gave to me when I graduated from grammar school from the eighth grade. And those cows multiplied, and he kept track of them for years for me, and that was my herd.
You know, I'm used to seeing you behind the piano. It's hard for me to imagine you as a cowboy.
Well, I could send you pictures. And there even are some what we call movies in those days, some of the very first kind of home movies where I'm with my dad lassing and branding and big roundup. So it is documented.
Did you sing cowboy songs?
Oh, all of them, yeah. When there were real cowboy songs like Strawberry Roan, and Little Joe the Wrangler, tunes that people don't sing anymore. I love those songs. The words can still make me cry, and I used to make my kids cry by singing, Joe, you take my saddle. Bill, you take my bed. Jim, you take my pistol after I am dead. And think of me, please, kindly, when you look upon them all, for I'll not see my mother when the work's all done next fall. Now, that's a cowboy tune.
Did you like singing?
Oh, yeah. I used to sing that, play my ukulele.
Ukulele, no, wow.
Some of my friends played guitar, cowboy songs, yeah.
Let me get back to what we were talking about, which was life on the cattle ranch. And there were two cattle ranches in your life, the one your father owned and the larger one that he managed. Did you have really strong arms and hands from the work, and do you think that that helped you as a piano player?
It didn't hurt. My mother would not allow my dad to have me rope anything larger than a yearling because she didn't want my fingers to become hurt. And my uncle, who was also a rodeo roper, got his finger caught between the saddle horn and the rope, and it took his finger right off. And he used to kid the other cowboys and said, I would have been a great pianist like my nephew Dave had I not lost his finger.
Now, I think in spite of the fact that you studied piano with your mother as a boy, you weren't very good at reading music. How well could you read when you started majoring in music in college?
I couldn't read. And that caused a lot of trouble in the conservatory. So I hid it until I was a senior by not taking piano. I'd take the other instruments were cello and clarinet, and so that I was just playing scales and getting by and doing the subjects I had to pass in. But in my senior year, they said, you have to take piano. And the piano teacher, in 5 minutes, ran downstairs to the dean and said, Brubeck can't read at all. So the dean said, you know, you're a disgrace to the conservatory and we can't graduate you. And when some of the younger teachers heard this, they went to the dean and they said, you're making a big mistake because he writes the best counterpoint that I've ever had, said Dr. Brown. And Dr. Bodley went in and said, you're wrong. You know, this guy is talented. So they convinced the dean to let me graduate. And the dean said, you can graduate if you promise never to teach and embarrass the conservatory. So that's the way I graduated. And that's the way I've gotten through life, is having to substitute other things for not being able to read well. But I can write, which is something very few people understand.
Now, your first record that I think really made an impression on the record-buying public, I mean, it got bought a lot, was A Jazz Goes to College.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sessions recorded at three different colleges.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a picture of you on it, and you're wearing your glasses. And those glasses were really such a part of your image. And I think in part because that record was Jazz Goes to College, and in part because of those kind of thick plastic glasses, you maybe had the image of being what was known in those days as an egghead?
I wish I had. I'm not that smart. But people forget that at the same time we had a huge following at places like the Apollo Theater,
mm-hmm.
the Howard Theater in Washington, and the universities that they used to call black universities, Afro-American universities. We played the so-called black clubs all through the South, where there were no white people came in. And in some of the black clubs, we were the only white group that came in. This is what I wish people would remember.
Mm-hmm.
And we integrated many, many universities in this country. And those are important things to remember. It wasn't just Ivy League places. We were really doing some work that people seem to forget how hard it was to do, where you had to have a police escort to the concert. The president of the college refusing to let you go on, and the students demanding you go on. I could tell you a lot of stories about that.
The problem was that you were white, or that one of the musicians in the band was black?
Eugene Wright was black, yeah.
So that was the problem.
And we couldn't do some television shows, because in those days you couldn't have black and white together. One show I had to turn down, Duke Ellington took, because at the moment he had an all-black band. Sometimes Duke would have a white drummer like Louis Belson, and that would maybe give him problems. They just didn't want mixed groups on television.
Let me play what might be the most famous of the Brubeck Quartet recordings, and that's Take Five, which you recorded in 1959. Would you talk about this composition? It's a Desmond composition, but I think you worked with him on it.
Yeah. Paul has done a radio show in Canada before he died where he said, I'm so fortunate that Dave assigned me to do the section in 5/4, because that was the one track I wanted Paul to do as a solo for my percussionist, the great drummer Joe Morello, because Joe would often play in 5/4 time backstage, which is a time signature that was very rarely, if ever, used in jazz. So I would hear Paul start to improvise over Joe playing on a drum pad before you'd go on stage. And so I said, just write some of the melodies, the ideas that you're doing, and bring it to rehearsal in a few days. So that's what happened. He came and he had some ideas that I thought were great. The first thing he said, I can't write anything in 5/4. I've tried and tried. I said, let me see what you got. So he showed me what he had, and I said, I can put this together, and it'll be great. And I put what he had together as theme one, theme two, and that's how the thing was born. And I named it Take Five, and he objected to that name. And I said, why, Paul? And he said, nobody knows what Take Five means. What does it mean? I said, everybody knows but you, Paul Desmond, what Take Five means. So I argued with him, and I kept that title, which I think is a great title. Then, of course, I later wrote the words to it. So I had a little bit to do with this tune.
Well, before we hear it, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your early career. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Dave Brubeck, speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. Next Tuesday, Brubeck celebrates his 85th birthday. He's still performing. Tonight, he plays in Munich. He'll celebrate his birthday next week at a concert with the London Symphony in London. Coming up, I'll review a new Showtime miniseries. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Now I'd like to end the show by putting on my TV critic hat and reviewing a new miniseries I really like. It's called Sleeper Cell, and it's a 10-hour drama from the Showtime cable network. And like a sleeper cell, whose strength comes from its invisibility until it strikes, this miniseries is an out-of-left-field surprise. It comes from writer-producers who have no hint of such complexity and ambition in their resumes. It stars people whose faces, for the most part, are unfamiliar. And by delving into the motives as well as the moves of Islamic terrorists operating in the United States, Sleeper Cell ends up being both instructive and unsettling. In framing Sleeper Cell, creators Ethan Reif and Cyrus Voris borrow the basic template from the 1980s TV series Wise Guy. In that show, Ken Wahl played an undercover FBI operative who spent time in jail to deepen his street cred, then emerged from prison to join the crew of a rising mob figure. In Sleeper Cell, Michael Ealy stars as Darwin, an undercover FBI agent whose personal background and convictions, he's black and a devout Muslim, make him the perfect agent to try to place with Farrakh, an Islamic terrorist assembling a crew of intentionally diverse holy warriors. The team includes a temperamental Frenchman played by Alex Nesek, a hip-hop-loving Bosnian played by Henry Lubadi, and a fair-haired American convert played by Blake Shields. Farrakh, the charismatic leader of the group, is played by Oded Fehr from The Mummy. His hold over his small but loyal team is as magnetic as it is firm. It's a wonderful performance, matched in intensity and subtlety by Ely as Darwin, the agent risking his life to befriend Farrakh. Here are Darwin, then Farrakh, explaining the origins of Sleeper Cell funding to the rest of the crew members.
So most of our funding comes from the wages of sin.
What are you talking about, man?
Poetic justice. Using the appetite of your enemy to raise the funds you need to wage war against him. Am I right?
In our case, from the sales of guns, Afghan heroin, and bootleg CDs and DVDs, all brought in through Mexico. Unfortunately, the brother who was in charge of protecting those interests of ours has died in a traffic accident in Tijuana. And now, for some reason, the money has dried up. No money, no Yom Hadin.
Judgment Day.
I'm driving down tomorrow. I'm gonna meet back.
Yo hablo español bastante bien. I speak decent Spanish.
Yo también.
Me too.
All right, settle then. Tell me, Ilya. Lay low, blend in. Nothing that would attract attention from the authorities. Have a Big Mac, go watch a movie in your multiplex cinemas. Just spend the weekend like a couple of average Americans.
No problem, dude.
Like Vinny and Wise Guy, Darwin in Sleeper Cell has an FBI handler, a responsibility shared in this miniseries by James LaGrosse and Sonia Walger. Together, they try to unlock the plans and targets of the people they're investigating and move in time to save lives. Sleeper Cell is as involved as The Wire, as intense as 24, and like both of those wonderful shows, leads to plenty of dead ends, sudden turns, and thrilling climaxes. The canvas explored by Sleeper Cell is centered in Los Angeles, but makes side trips to Canada, Mexico, Las Vegas, and elsewhere. Commendably, the drama is careful to shatter stereotypes and present varying extremes of commitment, compassion, and competence on both sides of the battle line. Best of all, it uses the miniseries format to put all its characters in palpable danger. Even the lead roles in Sleeper Cell can die at any time, and some of them do. And when the terrorists' master plan is revealed and set into motion, it's not just must-see TV, it's must-see leaning forward TV. Showtime already has made one giant leap forward this year with the quality comedy series Weeds, starring Mary Louise Parker. Now it's got a dramatic miniseries to match, and is rolling it out in the aggressive way ABC once presented Roots. Lots of hours, lots of nights in a row. Sleeper Cell runs Sunday through Wednesday for two straight weeks, an hour a night, then concludes the following Sunday with a two-hour finale I promise will be worth the wait. Sleeper Cell is itself a sleeper, but if you tune in, there's no way you'll be sleeping through it. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And from Warner Home Video, presenting March of the Penguins DVD, a family film about the journey that emperor penguins take in order to become parents. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Terry Garr. Before she worked with Mel Brooks in Young Frankenstein, Sydney Pollack in Tootsie, and Francis Ford Coppola in The Conversation, she was a dancer in a number of Elvis Presley films. She'll talk about all that and about her life after the diagnosis of MS. She has a new memoir. Join us for the next Fresh Air.